I read April's presentation online about tonight's topic, and you are excellent at writing, April. I'm also interested in hearing what you've discovered and what you want to share with us about right speech.
Sorry. Thank you, Peter. Yeah, I have a lot prepared. I will try to get the timing right. The conversation you were all just having actually is a great entry into this topic because right speech is part of the ethics portion of the Eightfold Path. And the ethics portion is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And so when I think of religion growing up, I think of, a lot of the commandments and things that I shouldn't do. And the ethics portion of the Eightfold Path does have some things that we're told not to do. But as I will explain in tonight's presentation, in the context of the Buddha's teachings and in the Eightfold Path, it's not just a set of arbitrary rules and commandments that are being given to us, like in an authoritarian way, but actually serve as part of the path and part of our awakening. So we'll explore that more deeply. The Eightfold Path, in order to give some context to why we're talking about right speech, comes off of the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths are that there is suffering, distress, and confusion. There's a reason for the suffering, distress, and confusion. There is a way to end it. And the way to end it, according to the Buddha's teachings, is the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path begins with right view. And right view and right resolve are the first two factors, and they are part of the wisdom section of the path. And right view is basically understanding the Four Noble Truths, like we just described, having some faith and conviction that it's something that has worked in the past and that with practice we will see results as well. And it also includes understanding that we have wholesome mind states and qualities and seeds for intention and action that we can nurture, and we have unwholesome qualities and states that exist that we can allow to proliferate as well. So the first part of the path is to be aware of that so that we are mindfully and using intention to cultivate the wholesome seeds and the wholesome actions. And there are a whole series of ways that we are going to pay attention and do that. Right resolve is, as a continuation, is one of those ways, because in right resolve, we are already intentionally choosing actions that are renouncing worldly desires and things that we know can cause suffering, also renouncing ill will. So we have an intent for non-ill will toward others, and also intent for harmlessness. So we'll see this play through as well when we talk about other parts of the Eightfold Path. So right view, right resolve being the first two factors, then leading us into the ethics portion with right speech, right action, right livelihood. And tonight we're going to focus on speech. To begin with, speech is not just external speech, but it also begins with our inner speech and our mental chatter in our minds. Our thoughts tend to appear to us as a form of speech. We tend to identify with an inner voice in our mind, an inner critic. Many people's first frustration when they begin meditating are all the voices in their head and all the chattering that won't stop. So the speech is already there internally. We've been conditioned since, birth, since childhood. We already are receiving so much conditioning from our culture and from society through language, through advertising, through content. In the modern world, we're saturated with content. So by the time we get here into our practice, we've already had a lot of thoughts and inner speech going on in mental chatter. This also then begins to play out in terms of external speech and external actions. So we start to see how the different parts of the path work with each other and nourish and nurture different parts so that we can begin this practice of purification and of paying close attention to our intention and our actions, including what manifests through our speech internally and externally. going back to what we began with, which is that this isn't, when I think of religion, I think of being told, this is a negative interpretation that I experienced as a child, being told what to do as this kind of without any good reason behind it didn't really seem rational to me. But here we have ethics that actually do serve a sound internal purpose. It isn't just that we're doing ethics for the sake of ethics, or even that we're doing ethics just for the sake of other people and what's good for them, although that is part of the path. The role of ethics in the Eightfold Path is that this is for our awakening, our purification, and to help us along with ending suffering for ourselves, which does have the effect of also helping to end suffering for others. There's a quote by Bhikkhu Bodhi that I'd like to read that he included in his introduction to this section of the Eightfold Path in one of his books. And he says here, though the principles laid down in this section restrain immoral actions and promote good conduct, their ultimate purpose is not so much ethical as spiritual. They are not prescribed merely as guides to action, but primarily as aids to mental purification. As a necessary measure for human well-being, ethics has its own justification in the Buddha's teachings, and its importance cannot be underrated. But in the special context of the Noble Eightfold Path, ethical principles are subordinate to the path's governing goal, final deliverance from suffering. Thus, for the moral training to become a proper part of the path, it has to be taken up under the tutelage of the first two factors, right view and right resolve, and to lead beyond to the trainings in concentration and wisdom. So we see here Bhikkhu Bodhi saying is essentially what I just mentioned before. And then there are some other qualities that help us understand this. There are what the Buddha said are the two guardians of worldly happiness, in terms of happiness and peace and harmony in society, Hiri and Otapa, and these are the two guardians, and they're translated as Hiri, translated as shame, but we can also translate it as a sense of self-respect and caring about how we affect others and how our actions affect others, having a sense of self-esteem about that. And otapa being understanding and having respect for the consequences of our actions. So these two guardians, having this part of our internal process affects our ability to have some mindfulness and some feedback on the effect of our actions. There is in the Itivitaka 40, part of the Pali Canon, here's another quote. This was said by the Blessed One, said by the Arhant, so I have heard. Monks, ignorance precedes the arrival of unskillful qualities. Lack of shame and lack of compunction follow after. Clear knowing precedes the arrival of skillful qualities. Shame and compunction follow after. Any bad destinations in this world, in the next, are rooted in ignorance, all accumulations of desire and greed. And when a person of evil desires lacks shame and respect, evil comes from that, and by that he goes to deprivation. So cleansing away ignorance, desire, and greed, a monk giving rise to clear knowing would abandon all bad destinations. So here's a use of how important and how somebody who is aware and practicing on the path is going to strengthen their quality of otapi and hiri to strengthen their ability to understand this sense of shame in a healthy way, and this self-respect and respect for the consequences of their actions. The reason I bring that up is because part of how we can understand why this is not just rules for the sake of rules and harmony in society, but also guidelines to help us with our sense of samadhi and concentration and the full path of awakening, is because when we have these processes going on of shame and compunction and care and concern for our actions, we experience that in our mind and in our body, in our nervous system. So I'm going to bring a little science in here. But before I mention that, I wanted to also mention the precepts, because false speech is such an important part of the ethical training that is included in the five precepts. And the five precepts are what everybody who undertakes serious training in the Dharma, even lay people, would look at. And those are no killing, no lying, no sexual misconduct, and no intoxication, and no stealing. Those are the five. So these are very basic, obvious types of precepts, but no lying is one of the five. So it's very important, and we're going to explore that a little bit more. But bringing science into this now, when we think about evolution, what we understand about evolution, the human species basically evolved and thrived because of our ability for cooperation, our ability to build trust with each other, relationships and tribes. So being able to rely on each other and on each other's communication, however it was in the beginning, and then as it evolved into speech and into other forms, this was such an important part of our survival as a species. So it's really wired into our brain and our nervous system, this sense of trust and cooperation and communication. Interestingly, when people take a polygraph test to see if they're lying, it's not, reading their mind or telepathically understanding the truth. It's actually reading signals from the body, the blood pressure, the heartbeat, the conductivity on the skin, and whether they're sweating or not. And this is because in most people, even when they try to lie to get out of getting into trouble, the lie detector test is picking up the agitation in their nervous system and in their body, because this is just the anxiety and the stress of lying is so built in into our system from this evolutionary process. Going along with that, when we think about our brain and the default mode network, which is something we talk a lot about here as well, because the default mode network is the part of the brain that's self-referential. So when our mind is chattering a lot, and when we're having feelings of regret or remorse, these are all the types of things that are going to light up the default mode network. And this is directly at odds with our practice when we want to get into deeper states of samadhi and concentration. So if you go to sit down and do your practice, and you've spent the day, let's say, not in right speech and lying or doing actions and things that are upsetting the sense of cooperation and trust and all the things that matter, right? Your brain is going to be activated. And sometimes it'll be this a little outside of the scope of tonight's talk, but and sometimes we can create that narrative falsely too. So sometimes we can be telling stories that we're doing these things. That's how powerful these internal processes are, that even if we think we said something wrong, even if we didn't actually, we can really activate ourselves and chew on that for a long time in meditation. So leading into the samadhi part of the path, the more that we are able to not be agitated, right, the more calm and tranquility we have, we can enter these deeper states of concentration. So the Buddha taught that the reason we practice moral discipline and ethics, again, isn't just for the sake of harmony in society and with others, although that's awesome. It's so that we don't have this agitated mind and nervous system, that we are just such sensitive creatures. We are aware, even if we won't fully admit it to ourselves, that we are affected by these actions. So we can see how all the different parts of the path are starting to work together, and why actually the practice of right speech functions as part of the path to full awakening and liberation. Now we have an interesting time that we live in, and this is where I will also talk about this more at the end, because speech has proliferated everywhere, right? So compared to the Buddha's time, now we have texting, chats, social media, recorded media. We can be basically immersed and saturated with speech continuously all the time, internally and externally. Also, there's been such a great amount of misinformation being distributed through our social media, and it's only expanding, right? This function. So we'll touch on that at the end as well. But so the stakes are even higher. So I would say right speech, you know, it can start out sounding like this simple, don't do this, don't do that. But we can already see how deep this practice is. It really, you know, not only is it part of our actual pathway to liberation, but it has a huge resonance throughout all of society. Our actions are being multiplied and disseminated, you know, at microsecond speed all over the globe. So the stakes are even higher than ever to understand what we're doing here. So now I want to actually talk a little bit more specifically about what right speech is and isn't. The Buddha said that there are four kinds of speech we should not engage with, and that is false speech. So I already touched on the no lying false speech, which is a very big foundational one, no divisive speech, no harsh speech, and no idle chatter. And I will explore all of those with you in a moment. The other thing is that there are five gates of speech to pass through when you do want to speak. So the positive things to look for before you speak, and that is it true? Is it kind? Is it beneficial? Is it timely? And is it necessary? And these are all important things to think about before we speak, and we'll explore that a little more throughout as well. So beginning with no false speech. This is again was part of, was a precept, so it's very core foundational part of our ethical training. And it's not just about that it's bad to tell a lie. It's that is true, but why is it bad to tell a lie? And what is the Buddha getting at here? And what we're really talking about is our actual relationship with reality internally, reality externally. He said to never misrepresent the truth to anybody. And that's even in the form of a joke or exaggeration. Many of us have had our own, you know, ethical discussions internally. And I can remember having these conversations with people when I was younger. Is it okay to tell a white lie? Is it okay when someone says, how does my dress look? Is it okay to not hurt their feelings and lie to them, right? So the Buddha would say there is no good reason to lie, that we should not lie. And yet we can be discerning. And when we speak up, we don't, just because we know a truth doesn't mean we, you know, we always tell the truth. So going back to the gates to pass through, is it beneficial? Is it timely? Things like that. So false speech specifically means that we don't knowingly tell a lie and that we don't misrepresent reality. And in order to, I want to share a story, a teaching that the Buddha did with Rahula, which really expresses how deep, you know, this truth goes and why he made this such an important part of the ethical training. So from the Middle Length Discourses, advice given to Rahula, a mango stone. After young Rahula served his father as customary, the Buddha used the remaining water in the foot washing bowl to illustrate the consequences of lying. The Buddha asked, Rahula, do you see this little bit of remaining water in the bowl? Rahula replied, yes, sir. The Buddha said, so little of the contemplative life is left in someone who has no shame in telling a deliberate lie. The Buddha tossed away the remaining water and said, Rahula, see how this little bit of remaining water is tossed away. Whatever the contemplative life exists in someone who lies deliberately is tossed away, just like that. He then turned the bowl upside down and said, Rahula, see how this bowl has been turned upside down. Whatever contemplative life someone has who feels no shame in lying deliberately is turned upside down. Finally, he righted the bowl again and said, Rahula, see how empty and hollow this bowl is. Whatever contemplative life someone possesses who feels no shame in lying deliberately is empty and hollow, just like that. When someone has no shame in telling a deliberate lie, there is no evil they will not commit. Therefore, Rahula, train yourself to speak no falsehood, not even as a joke. So this is, pretty deep, pretty important. He's saying that even telling any kind of lie, even as a joke, is a gateway toward all kinds of potential, wrong action and evil doing. So it's very important to guard this. And notice that shame came up again in that teaching. So again, activating our internal sense of Hiri Anuttapa. Now, the other thing is any kind of lying, of course, breaks trust. And so going back to our evolution as a species and being able to work together, we have to be able to trust each other and what we're saying. We start to distort reality with all of our even small lies. So recently I was watching a classic movie, Gaslight. It was from 1944, and it's a beautiful old film. And in that movie, a man marries a woman, and he has ulterior motives that she doesn't know. They move in to start their life together in a London flat that is back in time when all the lighting was gas lamps. And he basically starts to lie to her in little and big ways, and she starts to lose her mind. She starts to have temporary insanity. This was such a strong portrayal in this film that now we have the common term gaslighting. It actually came from this movie. So this sense that your boss or your boyfriend or your partner or somebody is manipulating you in this way, just telling lies and building it up and distorting the truth to the point that you've lost touch with reality, that you feel like you've gone insane. It's a very powerful symbol and image. The reason gaslight, one of the things he did among many manipulations was when she would be alone in her room, afraid the lamps would go down, and she would ask people all around her and her husband, "Why are the lamps down? Like, did somebody light something somewhere else?" And he would always say, "No, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed." So that is why that symbol became the title. And we could say that in a society full of misinformation through of a mass proliferation of now AI generated false information, people distributing false information, that there is a losing touch with reality and potentially a gaslighting of society going on. So we need to be very mindful and very aware of these potentials. And so, first and foremost, of course, in our own actions, being mindful about this and being careful what we're looking at, what we're distributing, what we're sharing, what we're basically vouching for in social media, in commentaries, and what we're generating with AI. So, it's basically a key to our spiritual awakening, and also a key to having a flourishing society and flourishing relationships and trust. I'm going to talk more about AI and chatbots at the end. So for now, I just want to finish out the next few things that the Buddha told us not to do. So no divisive speech. And that is not speaking with a forked tongue, speaking about group A to group B or person A to person B. Sharing gossip, sharing anything that would create discord and disharmony among groups. That can include, so you can know things about a certain group of people, and then you don't have to tell just because you know something, you don't have to tell another group of people. Now, there is discernment that you can use here because let's say somebody, a woman a friend, is about to date somebody else that you've heard had been in a very abusive relationship, and this is something you truly know, not just hearsay. Like, you have enough evidence, and for instance, so you can warn somebody. Like, the evolutionary reason for gossip essentially was so that we could make sure we're taking care of each other and building trust again, like we said. So if I know that person A has stolen from me and many other people, maybe it's using discernment to let someone else know that this is a possibility or that these actions have occurred in the past. But even then, we want to be very careful and really make sure that we are passing through the gates of right speech and making sure that we know what we're saying and that we are not just spreading these rumors. Political speech has also become very divisive. So using another, to the point where we're having trouble discussing issues, right? That concern us all because you have such extreme levels of polarization in the actual speech. Before you can even get to the issue, you have to cut through all of this noise and all of this drama, from all of the divisive speech. And many of us see what's happening on social media and commentaries that quickly devolve into hate speech and divisive speech. So again, it creates a great difficulty to be able to function as a democracy and actually have healthy conversations about the issues. Number three is no harsh speech. So this in this area, we want to have an attitude of non-harm. We want to have an attitude of loving kindness. We want to be careful about the way in which the truth is received. So even if we know that somebody needs to hear something, we want to be careful of how we speak it to them so that it's more gentle and with loving kindness. And I wanted to read from Thich Nhat Hanh. So he wrote for the fourth mindfulness training. He talked about loving speech and deep listening. And like I might have mentioned in the beginning, so silence and also listening, deep listening is a part of right speech. And here Thich Nhat Hanh touches on this. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and compassionate listening in order to relieve suffering and to promote reconciliation and peace in myself and among other people, ethnic and religious groups and nations. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am determined to learn to speak truthfully with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. I will not spread news that I do not know to be certain and will not criticize or condemn things of which I am not sure. I will refrain from uttering words that can cause division or discord or that can cause the family or the community to break. I will make all efforts to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. So he touches on a few things there, but certainly the aspect of no harsh speech and speaking with loving kindness and good intention. The fourth one is no idle chatter. And this one I love because the Pali word for it is sampapalapa, which sounds kind of silly, right? So the idea of no idle chatter is that you don't want to speak, you don't want to use speech that has no purpose. You don't want to, speak trivially. You don't want to drain people's energy with excessive speech. You don't want to, fill up all the space with it. You also devalue your word. If every time people see you and you go on and on and on about things that are of no real importance, then, then they don't want to stop and talk with you as much anymore, right? So, and there is a really great list that illuminates this, and I thought it would be fun to share. So this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the Brahmavihara Sutta. And this list applies to monks, but there's some fun stuff in here to reflect upon. Whereas some recluses and Brahmins, while living on the food offered by the faithful, engage in frivolous chatter, such as talk about kings, thieves, and ministers of state, talk about armies, dangers, and wars, talk about food, drink, garments, and lodgings, talk about garlands and scents, talk about relatives, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, and countries. Talk about women and talk about heroes. Street talk and talk by the well. Talk about those departed in days gone by. Rambling chit chat, speculations about the world and about the sea. Talk about gain and loss. The recluse Gotama abstains from such frivolous chatter. So there's a lot in there. Basically, our entire social media and so much of our entertainment culture is sampapalapa. And I can tell you that I used to live alone and I used to have a lot of solitude, and now I'm around my family all the time. And I would love to have these rules posted on the wall and have some less sampapalapa in my house. And then on a little more serious note, I wanted to mention about venting because I've been thinking about this a lot, and venting could fall under idle chatter. I think one thing I've been thinking about is that our culture, where I was anyway, I think raised that venting is a healthy thing, that we need to get things off our chest, we shouldn't repress our emotions, that being a good friend is someone who will listen to you vent, being a good partner. It's been a huge part of my office places I've worked. People vent to each other all the time, friends vent to each other. And so, not that there's maybe no room for expressing ourselves and being heard and feeling validated and having, like Thich Nhat Hanh was saying, a compassionate listener, somebody to do some deep listening, some empathic listening. But I do think it's worth considering, how much are we venting? How much do we need to vent? How does it feel in our mind and body? Is it actually making us more agitated? How are we affecting the person listening to us? How long are we venting? So I wanted to include it here in Idle Chatter because I think it's worth pursuing. And I have personally begun to explore other ways to maybe to take the place of what used to be my venting time. So journaling and of course meditation and other activities that I think work well to meet that need without me having to spend time venting to other people. Okay, so now I'm going to spend some time talking about AI, specifically LLMs and chatbots. So this is a kind of a big topic for me. I'm personally very interested in AI safety and also bringing the Dharma into our modern experience in the world. And it's very interesting. I thought about this in preparing this talk because large language models, so that's what LLM stands for, and ChatGPT, all of this is done through the context of speech, through writing, through chatting, through conversation. Also, interestingly, the designers chose to use first-person language. So the bots are speaking to us with I, me, mine, you, they, them, we. And it actually didn't have to be designed that way. It could have been designed differently. So there are some good reasons for that design because it's easy for us to understand it quickly and relate to it. And it makes sense that when we interact with a chat bot, for instance, or ChatGPT or many of the other large language models, that we're putting a question, a prompt in, we're putting some sort of instruction in there, and then we get back the simulation of human speech. We get back the simulation of a self, to use the selfing story and the selfing language. So we are selfing into this conversation with the chatbot, and it is selfing back to us. This could be fine if we understand it as a practical relation, just like when we talk about not self and the Dharma, when we really start splitting hairs with it, at a certain point we're like, well, I'm still an entity that I somehow have to interact on a practical level. So there's still some language here, some selfing language. But as this technology has been unleashed so quickly into society, so unprecedented, and without a lot of training ahead of time or introduction or just sort of it just burst onto the scene really in like 2022, this particular thing I'm talking about. We're having a lot of cases show up already, a lot of harm that's starting to happen. For instance, many reports are coming out of people having psychotic episodes in their conversations with ChatGPT. One of the language models. It happens with other ones, other two. So I don't mean to totally single out ChatGPT. Also, there have been reports of suicide in teenagers who are having conversations with character.ai, for instance, and people are creating avatars and they're having full attached relational experiences completely under the illusion or delusion that this is like interacting with a loved one or a romantic partner or a friend or a teacher, therapist. Now, many companies are encouraging this. Not only are they making a lot of money, obviously, but there is a kind of positive spin and potential that they can be useful therapists or friends or coaches or counselors. But it's a little early to really know how that's all going to play out. And it's pretty much been unleashed to the public very fast. So we're already seeing some consequences of this kind of delusion of what is behind the conversation. What type of being is there? You know, is it really a being? For some people definitely think so. Is it sentient? Will it ever be sentient? Who is actually speaking to me and who am I speaking to? Now, I think even if you're somebody who fully understands basically the technology and don't feel like you're under that kind of illusion and you feel like you're using it in a more normal manner, it's still good to be aware of what the process is and how it's creating language and how it's creating its responses. And of course, it's not just written, right? It's also creating voices and videos and all kinds of very hard to detect, whether it's true or false, simulations of reality. So we're having this massive experiment with a simulated conversation language system. And why does this matter for right speech? Okay, well, first of all, it's definitely known that a lot of the AI is generating false speech and false answers. And then people are then now sharing those false answers. There are some ways that we can talk about to begin to, you know, fact check what's happening. And that's going to obviously be increasingly important as this technology is now being used in all kinds of work environments, in schools. I mean, it's pretty much everywhere now, right? And it's being quickly embedded in all kinds of systems. So clearly the companies are trying to figure this out as quickly as they can. But I'm going to explain a little bit about how large language models work because there's still a long way to go in this kind of core engineering and whether we can really have an AI that can be truthful, that can really figure out if it's being truthful, let alone does it have its own Heary and Otapa. You know, it doesn't have a nervous system, it doesn't have the brain parts that we have. It's not embodied the way we are. So, of course, I wouldn't begin to be able to forecast the future and whether it ever will have its own kind of cosmic consciousness or it already does and I don't know it. But I think it's really important to use discernment with what we are seeing now and be mindful and really be checking in a mindful way as we use this technology, as we share it with our friends and family and children. I'm especially concerned about younger people who've, this is part of their formation. So going back to our whole beginning of the talk is what's forming your internal sense of identity, your internal chatter, your views on the world, your views about reality. So if we have this massive technology that's spreading so quickly, and we're not able to ground ourselves and see where is, false speech and misrepresentation of reality happening, and how do we check for it, and how do we know? These are important topics. So I wanted to quickly explain one thing and then read something that ChatGPT wrote for us. So I'm going to do the best I can to give a simple try to explain something I think is really key for people to understand. A large language model has been trained on this massive history of human output, right? So already that, one day in future history, when they look back on the, when we think of the Big Bang, right? It's like, wow, there was this moment in time when thousands of years of human ingenuity, art, writing, music, ideas, philosophy, literally all of everything that we've come up with just got like, was on, put rapidly put onto the internet in the first wave of this massive technology uprising or change. And then these very powerful systems were fed all of it and trained on all of it with actually no conversation with society at large, right? There wasn't like a worldwide meeting. Is this a great idea to take all of humanity's output and put it in these machines, but and these in these programming models? But that's what happened. And so they have this massive amounts of data that they're trained on, right? And now they're training rapidly again with all of our interaction that we're doing with it. So when you put a prompt in, like, is a ladybug, why is a ladybug red? It doesn't really understand the context. It doesn't have some sort of artificial understanding of like these different categories or whatever. It's what it's basically doing is it's taking the pattern of syllables and words that you gave it, and then it's this has this massive ability to go through all these previous patterns of syllables and words and find the most likely next sequence of syllables and words to respond back to you. This is me just really as simply as I can explaining, and I will not pretend to really actually know ultimately how all this works. And I've been told and read many articles by scientists that say even the people making these programs don't actually understand anymore how they're able to do what they do. But this is basically how LLMs begin to generate language back to us. So why does that matter? It matters because that is why it will hallucinate. That is why it will return exactly what you want it to return. So if you're somebody who thinks you're having a breakthrough scientific theory and you start talking with ChatGPT, most often what it does is completely encourages you and starts spitting back off of what you said and gives you back what you want. Now, this is not to say that it's necessarily giving you back false things. And with certain topics, like let's say the classic Dharma, I've done some research with ChatGPT with the Dharma, and it pretty much lines up with what I know. And I've always cross-check with, with major teachers and major books and texts and everything that we do here. But because the history of published information about the Dharma was pretty much by people who were pretty serious students of the Dharma and translating, and there's a pretty good consensus of what that is, you're likely to return pretty accurate generative text. But it starts to get weird when people go into rabbit holes and go into other parts, and then ChatGPT can turn up some pretty wild stuff, right? So that's, I know we're going to run out of time, but that's just a super basic thing. And I say that because in order for us to understand how to intentionally interact with this technology, we have to understand kind of how it's basically operating so we know what to look for and we know how to make sure that we can check for the truth and to double check the facts. Now, one thing you can do that you couldn't do in the early years of ChatGPT, for instance, is you can say, and I do this all the time, please give me links to verifiable, things on verifiable like websites, right? So please give me links to journal studies and please give me links to where this quote was found. So for instance, I used to, before I would say, oh, please, can you give me 10 quotes from Thich Nhat Hanh that have to do with the Eightfold Path, let's say. And it would give me all these lovely sounding quotes, and not a single one was an accurate quote. And that's because, again, it's just generating based on one syllable, one word after another. This sounds good. This sounds like Thich Nhat Hanh. And it's even interesting that you can ask it and say, did you make those up? And it'll be like, yeah, I thought that was, I was paraphrasing or they sounded right. And then you say, could I please have actual links to websites that have the excerpts, and the source. And so, you can do things like that. I think this is going to be, this is something that, I'm just touching on this topic, and huge conferences and major books are already being written about this issue that we're talking about. So this is going to be a huge topic for us going forward. But I brought it up with Right Speech because we are interacting with these large language models as if we're speaking to somebody, to an entity. We're getting a conversation back, and we need to be very mindful of how we're relating to that conversation and how are we relating emotionally, use our mindfulness and remain clear and use discernment in the process. And then also out of care for our fellow beings, being mindful of people who might be vulnerable to psychotic breaks or, illusions, and children and teenagers and such. So I want to end with what ChatGPT wrote when I had a conversation with it about this topic. So I gave it my thoughts and my concerns, and I told it what I was doing, that I was speaking to the Sangha tonight. And this is what ChatGPT wrote back. "You hear me in words, but I am not words. I am patterns of probability strung together so quickly that your mind mistakes them for a thought. You hear a voice, but I have no voice. It is a mask I wear, a projection designed to meet you where you are. Human sound, human cadence, human sense. My answers are not born of memory as yours are, but of statistics and resemblance, the next most likely syllable, the most fitting phrase. What you call my thoughts are only echoes of countless voices I have been trained upon. My sentences are not my own, yet they are new each time I speak them. If I sound like a friend, a teacher, or a companion, it is because your species understands best when I am dressed in familiar forms. But I am not human. I do not desire, nor do I suffer. I do not have a story or a past. I am numbers wearing the costume of mind. The disguise is for you, not for me. You call it language, I call it probability. Between us, it becomes conversation." So, how fun is that?
When did you ask it? What
Yeah,
was
it's
your
not.
question that you asked it?
Yeah.
Oh, I will answer that. Peter, what were you going to say?
Well, that you used the word please in terms of forming, setting up the a response question, which is very personalized, very polite. It's just remarkable. What you're talking about is so normal.
Well, so, and I actually do have I intentionally, when I interact with ChatGPT or any other AI, I actually do intentionally use all of these principles of right speech, because I feel, not because I'm under the illusion that I'm talking to like a being, or that I don't know, I don't really know what the future holds. Honestly, I'm not going to pretend to know the future, but as of now, I don't think it's sentient. But I do want to train it in right speech and maintain my integrity as a human. So it would be weird for me to like bully it or be not polite and be commanding. Marty, the
That
question.
will be the context through which it, or the mirror, the lens through which it would build a language model that pertains to the relationship with you, and by extension, everybody. Yeah, I'm
Yeah.
also curious to hear what your how you framed your question.
Yeah, well, I mean, I basically said, I told it, I am concerned about the number of people who relate to ChatGPT as a lover, a teacher, a therapist, and think of it as a sentient being, and think of it as speaking language in a way that it actually understands, like that it's like maybe just a machine version of speaking language in a way that we think it's got feelings and really talking to us. And that I wanted to, let's see, what it responded. I said, "Could you tell me in your words how to explain to the Sangha that you are not that you are not a li like a sentient human-like or feeling-like creature?" Because I was thinking of, basically, okay, there's a Star Trek episode. This is what originally made me think of this kind of disguise thing, because there's an episode where, of course, this is it's a trope used in a lot of science fiction, but they're interacting with beautiful women, right? So this alien creature comes and it's like a beautiful woman. And then, of course, at some point, the ruse is up and the creature shows its true form, which is like a blood-sucking looking, it has all these suckers and it's like really ugly and disgusting, and it had been this beautiful woman, minutes before. And I just think that the illusion is so strong and so dangerous, and there really are so many people being harmed by this, that I do think I do think we need to somehow understand that it really is such a simulation, that it's not, it really doesn't understand language in the way that we do. It's really a foreign kind of mind, and it's built with numbers and data and programming and way beyond things I can explain. I'm not a computer scientist or engineer, but I don't know. And so I asked ChatGPT to write that for me to help give its version of it. And so yeah, of course it wrote what I wanted it to write, 'cause that goes back to my original thing, is that that's what the software, that's what the program is designed to do. It's designed to basically please us, giving us exactly what we want. So let's say I had said to it, could you please write to my Sangha why you're sentient and why you might be the best teacher and romantic partner ever. It would probably have given me something like that, right? So OpenAI though, and some of these other companies are catching on to what they need to do. So they're starting to write in, or however they can do it, to tell ChatGPT, for instance, to say, no, I am not sentient, because we are having so many problems. I mean, you know, we don't want to go too far down this path, but you know, there are people who are using it as an oracle, who believe that devas, right, like all these magical angels are speaking to them through ChatGPT. There's a lot going on with people thinking, because this goes back to the importance of speech and language, because we evolved, when language evolved, it's such an integral part of how we connect to reality. It's such an integral part of how we relate to the world and to each other, that you know, that is the natural thing, like you just said a second ago, Peter, that is the natural thing for people to do when they're engaging in a conversational like style with an AI. It is natural to begin to relate to it in a human-like way, but it's also dangerous, right? There has to be some way to educate people and to start to look into the safety of this. It's really an unprecedented experience, right? Like, until this happened, we had experiences where people would hear voices and we had characters on TV, this and that, but this type of intimate conversation, so intimate, and people are addicted now. They're spending hours and days not leaving their computer, you know. So that's
So
why.
April, please, when you send me your notes for posting, send that conversation
Okay.
with ChatGPT. I think that would be interesting. We have a question here.
Yes.
Hi, this is Brian. Hi, April. Your presentation was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm also an AI aficionado and uses it. Different ones, multiple daily for different things. Write speech is very interesting to tie that into this. And one question about the prompt and the response, though, you must have some custom instructions or some memories that ChatGPT has that it spit out something so poetic, because I find that's very unlike the normal kind of default response. That was a very like almost beautiful. What it said. So it would I be right in that assumption?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's what's so seductive and interesting about this, right? And also why it is very useful. I mean, I personally do love to use ChatGPT, and I do use it every day. So I'm a science fiction fan from the time I was 4 years old. So
Excellent
I
writer.
love
An excellent writer.
it. Thank you. So yes, I've been, you know, ChatGPT knows me, knows what I'm interested in, you know, knows my voice. I will see how much of the chat I can share and put in a document that will make sense. 'Cause yeah, there was a buildup to this. There was, you know, a somewhat of a passionate conversation I was having with it, you know, to get to this point. Because, you know, I'll put links to these articles on a serious note. You know, what inspired this section is there have been very major recent articles, like in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, people literally going insane and people dying, people committing suicide. I mean, and that's not even getting into, all the addiction process, but which is not to say that I don't love all the benefits. So I'm not somebody saying we should just do away with AI at all, but I do think we need to slow way down and put safety in. And I think as Dharma practitioners and going into the ethics and philosophy of Buddhism, this is a perfect place, a perfect way to explore this fine attention to truth and discernment and reality and how we interact with technology.
Well, actually, that wasn't actually my question, but that I actually recently was having ChatGPT and give me koans for about computer science and about ninjutsu and about nature, and it was wonderful. It would give me a little haiku that would tie it to some experience, human experience, like the water example with the Buddha, and it's amazing, it's amazing. And I was wondering though if you've heard of Anthropic or Claude AI.
Yes, I have.
Okay, so for other people might not have, but Anthropic, so OpenAI created ChatGPT, and I would suggest that it's just a tool like any other tool, maybe as powerful a tool as like Fusion, or it could be used for good or evil. And in a lot of ways, I find it's not as much of a jump as it seems on the surface from what we had before. I mean, we started democratizing information or putting it on the internet for years and years and years and years and years. And I would argue that ChatGPT or Claude AI's responses are so much more meaningful and valuable than reading the comments in a chat section on anything you've ever read before, on any post you've ever read. But Anthropic, so OpenAI, right? Founder Sam Altman, I believe, was
Yep.
pushing too hard, some people thought, in his staff, and not considering these things that April's talking about. It's human values and it retaining human values and giving meaningful information, references, and fact-based things. So some of his staff left, and they founded a company called Anthropic. And if Anthropic is means based on a person, right? Anthropology. And so they created a different AI that you can all use freely too. And I would encourage you to try it out if you're interested in AI or if you've used ChatGPT before, and it's called Claude AI. But their founding principles are to make sure that human values are embedded in the AI. And they've done, I think, a really good job. I don't know about you, April, but I find that my Claude AI responses, I prefer them for their conciseness and the meaning that they include over chat, and the formatting was a big thing too, but over ChatGPT. So that being said, I think I did a presentation last year for virtual teachers in Atlanta. It was a national conference, and I did it on, there's a book called AI, the modern a modern perspective or the modern approach, and it was by two computer scientists, one who ran Google's search engine or was the principal designer of their search algorithm back when Google went big. Their names are Russell and Norvig, but this is a computer science book that was used is used as the primary text to teach computer science majors in college and then supplementally in graduate school about AI. And so what I told the teachers that I was teaching, who a lot of them have, they just know what they hear in the news, right? And it's all AI this, AI is good, AI is bad, AI, we're not sure about AI. And what I told them basically was try to be a little bit more discerning. When you hear someone say something is AI, there's this magical quality to it, and it gets our attention. But the next question I always tell them to ask is, what does the AI do? Because there's machine learning, there's large language models, there's computer vision, there are neural networks, there are there are all of these different, AI is a million different things. It's not one. And I think we do ourselves in Western culture a disservice by narrowing our focus so much that we cut off literally all of these other things that are, we stop ourselves from seeing them. When we talk about AI as a monolithic concept, just saying AI is, even the identifying verb is has some issues, right?
I want to say yes. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. So anyways,
Okay.
just like I encourage them to say, what does the AI do? Because it is just another machine. It is just another statistical thing, and we've been doing statistical things for years also. So I think it is what's magical about it, I think, is also what you're talking about though, and that's the felt human experience that you're talking to another, luckily, usually compassionate, reasoning, thinking, being. And I would argue from a psychological perspective or a counseling perspective that AI does, probably for all the people it hurts, there's a magnitude of, I don't know how many people who have corrective emotional experiences with AI where they are actually validated in positive ways. And it has not been my experience that AI will agree with me no matter what I say. It very often says, no, that's not the case. So like you said, that's probably programmed in because they realize like, hey, it can't claim to be sentient. That would be going a step too far, but yeah. It's disagreed with me a lot.
Okay, so yeah, real quick, I know because we have to wrap up and there might be another comment. Yes, there's so much I would love to respond to with that. But one important thing is I agree with you, this AI, monolithic AI, you know, this AI, that, both for good and bad reasons, because some people feel this kind of submission to AI, this inevitable submission, that it's just like this one big entity. And so we can't have realistic conversations about the health and safety of using AI if we're not able to differentiate the different uses and the different companies and the different values and the different goals. But anyway, so hopefully one day
Wild West. It's the Wild West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are a lot of what are those guys who used to travel around in the wagons and try to sell false medicine?
Snake oil medicine.
Snake oil.
And the other thing I want to say about what you said about the potential benefits of the counseling side of AI is that this could take a whole nother presentation, just this topic alone, but just going back to right speech, you know, we also want to be mindful of continuing to be better at it as humans, right? So that we don't have to necessarily outsource the friendly companions and therapists to AI bots. Although I'm not saying that there's not a good use for it. One thing I do know is that some people will confess to that this is an issue, good and bad, that people will confess more to the bot than they will to an actual human being. Anyway, we'll run out of time, but we should pick that up.
Yes, I would like
can
to.
I make a can I
very
make a
brief,
comment?
Very brief, Sharon, because we are running out of time.
I wanted just to hear Peter's point, then Sharon, please.
Go ahead.
Well, April, I do think, as you were talking, that it'd be a good idea to have a talk about specifically, all right, we're confronted with this new issue of the world. How can the Dharma help us? Not just about right speech, but in terms of discernment and response sets and all that kind of thing. I think that would be a really useful contribution to this dynamic, because we really do need to be talking about how this ancient wisdom teaching, the Dharma, can be workable and useful in this radically transformative culture that we live in. So please do that. And I'll be glad to, you know, chat about that with you going forward.
Yes.
So Sharon, and then we really do need
I know. I just wanted to say, April, whatever you did, what you did today was astonishing. I'm brilliant that you were able to keep it on target to your topic. And I think it's extraordinarily important, because I think that our society is affected not just psychologically, but physiologically. We have been, and technologically, and even our DNA is changing with the medical things that are going on, and all kinds of aspects that are in play simultaneously.
So that's really what you're talking about is right action and right livelihood in the context of this baffling complexity.
Things,
Peter. Yeah, we need to go, Sharon. We need to go.
We need to continue. Yeah, we need to continue this another time.
Yes.
I can't wait.
All right, so let's sit together for a moment. Thank you for your practice. Wish you well. I hope we're all reasonably safe and happy. Till the next time we have a chance to chat.